Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of The Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you doing? Just before the show, we were remarking that despite being you're just into your 30s and I'm almost in my 30s, we feel increasingly like old men, and the other day someone called you a pensioner.
Yes, I discussed something on a CRA video, and one of the YouTube comments was that I'm a pensioner. And the wonderful thing is about that is I now get to, you know, just tut at young people on this, like when I walk into a mall, I just, you know, and that's a great benefit. And the other thing is I'm pretty much a pensioner at heart. I think my age at birth was like 42. So I'm now well into my 70s. What a hell of a life I've led. I remember the winter of discontent, Thatcher coming to power, the Union, Scargill.
And bringing some much-needed youth to the podcast, we have Mlondi Mdluli. Mlondi, how are you doing, man?
Hi, Nicholas. I'm good, and you? Thank you very much for bringing me back on, you know, the show. It's, you know, like, it's a pleasure to be back. It's a pleasure.
It's good to have you back, man. Like I said, apparently we're aging incredibly fast, so we desperately need younger people like yourself to, you know, pick up our broken bones once we all waste away. But anyway, let us first give you a word from our sponsor this week before we get too much into our analysis here. And this is from our friends at Bitvice. And to hear some few words from them. Bitcoin is the complete hedge against the global debasement of money, inflation, and government overreach. Bitvice is a South African-first Bitcoin-only self-custody solution that helps individuals and entities buy and hold Bitcoin for the long term. Bitvice believes that everyone should hold their own Bitcoin and trust no one else. Recently, there have been a plethora of crypto custodians going bankrupt, taking their clients' Bitcoin with them. This is why Bitvice never holds your Bitcoin. They send it immediately to your own Bitcoin wallet where you hold the keys. They don't hold your keys. They don't hold your coins. Simply sign up to Bitvice, link your bank account securely, and buy Bitcoin in seconds. Visit bitvice.io and begin your journey in buying and securing the scarcest asset that mankind has ever created. And we thank them very much for sponsoring the show today. Anyway, let's get started with some comments made recently by our former president, Thabo Mbeki, who... as we have pointed out, the IRR has actually probably one of the best track records of South Africa's democratic presidents, despite having many, many problems in his time as president. But anyway, so he's, you know, he's an interesting voice on our political stage because he went quiet, especially through the Zuma years, having fallen very low in the public's estimation, I think, at the end of his tenure. But he's since reemerged to criticize the ANC, to say that it really needs to get its act together. So former President Thabo Mbeki recently attacked the ANC for his failure to address what he called the triple challenge of poverty, unemployment, and inequality. The government seemed to have no plan to address these problems, he said, warning that rising poverty and hardship, poor governance, and mounting lawlessness could see SA erupt into its own version of the Arab Spring. The Arab Spring uprisings, which I believe began in 2011, went across the whole of North Africa and the Middle East, and they overthrew a lot of authoritarian regimes in Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya. However, as I'm sure many people know, what followed that was a fairly mixed bag, and actually we're going to get back to the Arab Spring and where it is today towards the end of the show. But a lot of people were very upset by the economies of these countries and how they were both authoritarian in that they didn't allow people to really have much influence over government, but also how they were dominated by corruption and patronage networks, particularly those that fed off of oil. And that there was a feeling, especially amongst young middle-class people, that this benefited only political and economic elites. And Mbeki made the point that the existing constitutional orders here had become so delegitimized that they collapsed under the weight of social discord. So, Mlondi, let me start with you. Do you think the former president is correct when he says that we are at risk of a an Arab Spring type situation in South Africa?
Well, Nick, definitely he's correct, because if you look at the factors that have led to the Arab Spring, it's basically a corruption as well as high youth unemployment as well.
Reading that list, it sounds a bit familiar, doesn't it? When you think about what caused it.
Yes, it actually hits home. So, I mean, we're not so far from it, especially when you look at what happened last year in 2021 during the July unrest. So, so it's those factors that, that it's,
right. If you want something to demonstrate the delegitimizing of the state, losing complete control over a province for a month is for a few weeks is that's pretty high on the list, I would think. So I do agree with you. But at the same time, there's also maybe a lot of people have been talking about South Africa as having this ticking time bomb. They talk about something like high youth unemployment, which is a contributing factor to the Arab Spring. Herman, do you agree with me and Blondie that this could be perhaps a realistic outcome for South Africa's future if there isn't political and economic change?
No, I don't. And then someone in the comments asked, what am I looking for? I have a book on the Arab Spring somewhere here, but I can't seem to lay my hands on it now. One of the reasons why I don't think an Arab Spring is likely a future portent for South Africa is I think we're already there to a very large extent, where the expectation, and what happened in the Arab Spring is that you had strong governments with resentment building up, very much like a pressure cooker. And then when there was release, it was quite cathartic, it was quite catalytic, and it was quite dramatic. In South Africa, we don't have a strong state. We have a relatively weak state. And if we go look at the data, this sort of South Africa's issue will be less than a time bomb and more just like a bland fuse, where the problems, if you take the Arab Spring and you stretch it out over 15 years, you'd probably get something very close to what's been happening in South Africa. We see a rise in more than in 440% over the last decade in service delivery protests. We see a similar spike in the proportion of those protests being violent. So what happened in the Arab Spring, I do think we have to be honest, has already been happening in South Africa just over a much longer period. So where the Arab Spring is a moment of brief, dramatic revolution and change, South Africa's is more toxic, more erosionary, and I think more cynical.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting idea, actually, that we've sort of been doing the slow motion Arab Spring. And that is perhaps why the government has remained in power for so long, is because there hasn't been that sort of dramatic moment when it all comes falling down in one go. Although we may be approaching that.
Yeah, well, I think we are approaching localized Arab Spring-ish events, the July riots. But one of the things is that we would rather see an escalation in regularity of these occurrences rather than one fundamental thing that changes the narrative. We are perhaps closer to a Sri Lankan situation where economic policy and frustration builds to a point of a big dramatic action like the storming of the presidential residence or whatever. But what we also must remember is that where South Africa has a relatively low population density, and that if we're going to look at how these social contagions or socioeconomic contagions spread, you need denser population spread across your key areas. Something that starts in KwaZulu-Natal might spread a bit into Gauteng or into the Eastern Cape, but there's no real reason for it to spread much further. These large rural swathes that South Africa has is a sort of a break on the rapid escalation of civic unrest to a national scale. So number one, I disagree with you because I think we're already there. We're in a slow-mo car crash rather than in a dramatic, you know, explosion. And number two, the country is just different. These things, the fuses are just, you know, more dispersed.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting case because, you know, another factor that added to the what happened in the Arab Spring, I think, was the influence of sort of like radical Islamist groups, the sort of Salafist jihadi groups, which already had, you know, a presence over the Middle East. And so, especially in places like Libya, they could really, and Egypt to a certain degree, they could step into the gap and, you know, created by the delegitimization of the government and actually arm people and create a sort of civil war situation, which definitely happened in Libya.
And the last point from me, sorry for hogging the time, I'll shut up after this. We shouldn't forget the role played by the international media in the legitimization of the Arab Spring protests that led to Western governments signing on to tacit or explicit economic or even military, as in the disaster of Libya with the French, the Brits, and the Americans becoming militarily involved against Gaddafi. One shouldn't underestimate the sort of declining outrage appeal that Africa and especially South Africa holds. Mm-hmm. I can't see the global outcry happening about events in South Africa, similar to those in the Middle East, in Tunisia, where for a decade before these events, the media really invested in resources into those countries to understand them due to the context of the war on terror. You had a journalistic class with understanding or at least opinions on the area where these civil uprisings occurred that could then feed the narrative into the mainstream Western media that could then action Western governments into taking a position that would legitimize the consequences, especially the claims for regime change. There isn't a parallel in South Africa. There isn't that journalistic investment in what's going on here. There was in the 80s, but events now will be, to quote Neville Chamberlain, happening to people, far-flung people of whom we know nothing and whom with whom we have little in common. So I think that's another key parallel missing.
I think that's actually a really great point. I've heard that a lot of I can't name them off the top of my head, but that some of the foreign news agencies used to have their sort of Africa Bureau headquarters in Johannesburg, and they have since moved those to places like Nairobi, which I think really contributes to that declining. It's a very tangible sign of that declining lack of interest in South Africa as a place. You know, nowadays, I think we're just increasingly seen as another African country. There was a time when even I remember when I went to Indonesia when I was like 8 in 2001. The only thing any one of the Indonesians knew about South Africa was Nelson Mandela. And nowadays, I wonder if people even know that much. It's an interesting question. Anyway, so we've gone very long on this one, so let me move on to our next one. This is one of those stories about how China, I think, interacts with the world. I'm not entirely sure what to make of it. So I'd like your thoughts, gentlemen. According to a nonprofit organization in the US called Aerospace Corp. So it is funded by the US government, but it's not run by the US government. There is a Chinese rocket, a Long March 5B rocket, which they launched on July 24th. Apparently, the booster parts of this rocket, so the satellite got into space, but the boosters will fall down in an uncontrolled re-entry around July 31st. And the possible debris fields include most of the US as well as Africa, Asia, well, not all of Asia, Australia, rather, India, Brazil, Southeast Asia. So if you can imagine the sort of cone across the world stretching from the US and ending in Australia. And that there's a high probability, there's an 88% there's a more than 50% probability that these booster rockets will hit a part of the world that that has fairly high population densities. And so, you know, it's unlikely you're going to get hit by the booster. Most of the Earth is, in fact, still water. However, it's a little bit concerning that a piece of space debris could potentially fall on someone's house, especially when it's not even in the country that launched the space debris. But what's interesting about this is the Chinese state media's response to this criticism of the, reckless re-entry of the booster rockets. One Chinese media outlet said that the warnings are just, quote, sour grapes from people resentful of the country's development as a space power. The Global Times newspaper, which is the Chinese state sort of English language spokes voice. If you want the Chinese state's perspective on anything, you should go read the Global Times. They quoted a Shanghai-based television commentator who said, quote, the U.S. is running out of ways to stop China's development in the aerospace sector, so smears and defamation become the only things left for it. The U.S. and Western media deliberately exaggerate the loss of control of Chinese rocket debris and the probability of personal injury caused by rocket debris, obviously with bad intentions. Mlondi, what do you make of this?
What I found very funny,
disturbing is the only word that comes to my mind.
The fact that they don't actually dispute, these claims. So they don't they know it's true, but so they're just not disputing it.
There is. Yeah. The response is something like, you people are just being babies.
true. So that's so that was my take, and that's what I actually took a note of. Herman, it's kind of very funny, to be honest. Yeah.
Herman, I mean, imagine for a minute that a piece of Chinese space debris actually hit a city in, I don't know, let's say Thailand. What do you think the ramifications of that would be?
Oh, I mean that's a disturbing thought. That is quite a disturbing thought. It becomes a complex question, because what exactly is it? Is it an act of God? Is it an act of war? Is there a delictual claim that could be set in against the Chinese state? Just the legality of it will probably inform the politics of it if we are lucky, because if the legality has no bearing, it just immediate escalation. And with China's current global geopolitical currency being quite weak, especially after the COVID crisis and their handling of it and the blame that they received geopolitically, it is likely to be a massive embarrassment to China, and weaken the sort of latent emergence that we've been expecting of the Chinese for 20 years now. It will cost, as in the Russian space race, it will cost then prestige in something of a new Cold War. The failure on a scale of space exploration is never something that bodes well geopolitically. It's part of why the risks and the stakes were so high between Russia and the US, and why you had real tension, because failure there would have been embarrassing and catastrophic. But Nandi is absolutely right. It does illustrate the sort of unique, isolated position that the Chinese government can just hold.
Right. They seem to have a kind of disregard for public. Like, the Chinese state is just not great estimation of soft power, unless it involves financial support. They're very good at finding people who will take money from them and as a result adopt a softer line towards China, but they're very bad at sort of winning the argument, which I guess is to be expected. But the Soviets never had this problem. The Soviets, I think, were very good at arguing their case on the world stage and convincing a lot of people that actually the real problem was the US. But the Chinese just don't seem to have the same capacity. And I think that what you'd see in the event of, let's say, a piece of debris hitting, I don't know, it could even be as relatively minor as, let's say, a house or a farm in Australia. To be fair, this is probably quite unlikely because anyone, you know, the Chinese do have a point when they say that this is a bit exaggerated, because while the debris is almost certainly going to fall in a part of the world where most of the population lives, most of the world is actually either water or empty space. So the likelihood of actually hitting someone is quite low.
And you also have the question of burn up on reentry, and, you know, it's not a massive risk, but it does say something about the attitude.
Exactly. I think if it did cause some damage, the Chinese state would probably either deny that it had anything to do with them and that this was some kind of propaganda Western lies, or they'd sort of retreat into a kind of North Korea-type fortress mentality where they just said that, you blaming us for our rocket falling on you is just part of your attempts to destroy our glorious revolution. And it just wouldn't go down well. Anyway. Something interesting to think about. And I would also, on your point, Herman, about the space race, the Soviets really impressed the world with their incredible achievements in the space race in the early stages. Mm. And the moment that program went backwards, as you said, it really hurt their prestige when their rockets started blowing up.
The Cold War at that time, similar to now, was sort of a battle for the hearts and minds of two very weird demographic groups. The urban, the suburban intellectual academic elite, and the third world. And both of those, space exploration sort of ticks two boxes. It ticks the box of scientific and technological advancement, so it has this very cerebral component to it. But on a very basic level, it's just, you know, you send people to space. That appeals, that means you've got money, that means you've got ideas, that means you can conquer things, you can do things, you can solve problems, you can, you know, cross frontiers, which again appeals to a sort of a third world audience. And it's very, very similar now with China having its Belt and Road strategy. Were something to go wrong, it would give the geopolitical opponents of China, you know, the traditional West, a lot of ammunition to perhaps use that opportunity to re-engage with the third world as, you know, the battle for the hearts and minds of Africa and South America and perhaps, you know, the Asian subcontinent.
On that point, actually, there's been a little bit of discussion about Sri Lanka with regards to that, because Sri Lanka took big loans from China and leased their port, their major port, to the Chinese as part of that. And when the crisis, the financial crisis hit, apparently they did go to the Chinese and say, can you restructure our debt? And the answer they got was silence. I think that has really hurt the Chinese soft power in the third world. Anyway, enough on that. So returning to this question, the Arab Spring. Tunisia, which is generally being considered, I think it was the place where the Arab Spring started. It's where that man, I know it was mentioned in the comments just now, I've forgotten his name already. He was a shopkeeper and he set himself on fire to protest the just abuse he had suffered basically at the hands of the state. I think they had denied him a vendor's license and he was at his wit's end financially, kind of at the end of everything. And so he set himself alight and this really sparked outrage first in Tunisia. And then once major protests with political success began in Tunisia, that spread to Egypt and Bahrain and to even to Jordan, Saudi Arabia, all these countries across the Middle East, Morocco as well, I think. And in a number of those countries, namely Libya, Egypt, and Tunisia, the government did in fact fall and Syria fell into a civil war, which is still ongoing, unfortunately. There we go. It's the... For those watching on YouTube, the guy's name is on screen who immolated himself. Anyway, so Tunisia was generally thought to have come out of the Arab Spring the best. It had established a democratic system. There were free and fair elections. But a sort of fairly hardline Islamist party, I believe, won some of the early elections. And they've had increasingly troubled politics since. Well, their current president, President Kais Saied, recently ousted parliament and has been ruling by decree. He then put together a new constitution for Tunisia, which greatly expands the powers of the president, removes checks on him from the judiciary and the legislature and essentially empowers him to rule as something close to an autocrat. This constitution was put to the public. The opposition urged that the public boycott it, which they seem to have, at least to some degree. The turnout for the vote was only 30%. However, that didn't make a difference because the constitutional change passed with about 92% support. So I don't think it would be entirely unfair to say that Tunisia has voted itself sort of out of a democracy. Who knows? Maybe they'll come back to it, but it doesn't look great for them. So I guess we're kind of left with an interesting question. You know, Tunisia has, after just over 10 years, seems to have ended back in something similar to a situation which it was in. And part of the reason for this, according to the Reuters interviews that were done with various Tunisians, is just an incredible amount of apathy and disgust with the political system. Some people interviewed said, quote, "I'm frustrated by all these politicians. I'd rather enjoy this hot day than go and vote." Another person said, "I have no hope of change. Kais Saied will not change anything. He only seeks to have all the power." And Tunisia has been in some kind of economic decline since 2011, with them having to seek a $4 billion loan from the IMF. Herman, let me start with you. What do you make of this?
Well, on the Arab Spring issue, I think it it brings into something of a sharp relief the traditional liberal West's inability to understand communities and nation states that have significantly different histories, that you can't trace, you know, necessarily back with a colonial heritage. You can't trace it perhaps back to the Enlightenment. You can't trace it back to the Reformation. Those sort of founding events of the last 1,000 years of Western civilization, if we can call it that. The idea of creating it sort of a, and I like, I sort of have, don't have a particularly low opinion of George W. Bush, but it's sort of that idea that, you know, once you get democracy going, it is self-sustaining. I think that that ignores many of the cultural and especially religious contexts of how authority is understood to operate in many of these countries. The sort of soft Christianesque, soft Judeo-Christian, soft secular West, the heartland of liberal democracy and the nation state based on constitutional liberal democracy, actually does quite badly when it comes to understanding something that might, cultures that might be religiously quite fundamentalist. And I think ever since the Enlightenment, the increasing secularity of government and state, not that I'm taking a position whether that's good or bad, I just think a necessary consequence of it is that the interplay between something like a secular democratic statal structure, the idea of a constitution, can so easily be overvalued because the concept of it culturally and religiously isn't quite as deep-rooted as one might think from a Western perspective. I think this is a typical example of a mismatch between system and society that isn't unabridgeable, but it would need massively a different approach than merely Arab Spring, West approves Arab Spring, economically and politically prop up a new government will then become democratic, liberal in the broadest sense, and ensure a form of constitutional democracy. I think this highlights the poverty and the shallowness of that thinking, and something that one regularly encounters with American politicians, but even more so with continental European politicians and diplomats, where the idea of different cultures, a frame of reference and authority different than the traditional Judeo-Christian European style, it isn't deeply understood, and I think this might be an example of that.
So I'm not sure if I entirely agree. I think, you know, when you're looking outside of the European context for very successful free nations, there's three great examples in the East which have maintained their strong cultural roots: Japan, Taiwan, South Korea. but have, you know, become completely free nations who do their own thing and are pretty successful. And India to a certain degree, although it's like it's a complicated place.
What I would just caution there is I do think one should look at the religious history of those areas, where the idea, the local religious understanding of authority, I think, allowed more of that to happen than in your more fundamentalist, you know, Islamic or Christian or whatever theistic positions might be.
So my alternative explanation here is that the forces of liberalism in places like Tunisia were perhaps not well equipped by the outside world, who fairly either ignored them or didn't really think too much of them, to fight the battle of ideas in their home countries and convince people that you know, that liberalism was the way to go. I mean, when you have an Islamist party winning the most votes once a free and fair election is held, it suggests to me that the opposition hasn't done a great job of convincing people. And you can see from the low turnouts in this particular example in the Tunisian election, it's not that people are super enthusiastic with the president's power grab here, but they look at the opposition, they go, I don't know, hey? I think that there's a lesson to be learned there about how if an opposition in a country that's been going through a sort of dysfunctional period doesn't get itself together.
I just quickly want to say something. I see Andre in the comments says, Herman, Tunisia is a Muslim country. It's been so for hundreds of years. The last time anyone would... Yes, that's exactly the point I'm making. That is why the model of a sort of a colonial inheritance of Western liberal constitutional democracy isn't something to naturally take root there. So yes, I'm not saying they're not a Muslim country. I'm saying exactly what you're saying there. It does have the system-society mismatch. But I hear what you're saying, Nick. I hear what you're saying.
All right, sorry, Mlondi, we've actually gone over time, but do you have anything in sort of 15 seconds or so to say just to close up?
Yeah, I wanted to say that the people of Tunisia will most probably... I regret this note like in the next 10 years or so, because I think it's a bad move, to be honest, and they will regret it. So,
I definitely agree with that. All right, sorry, we are very much over time. So thank you very much, everyone, for watching and listening. We will see you tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. And I hope you all have a wonderful and fantastic day. Cheers, everyone.